He indicated nothing to either of us. He has nothing to do with why I decided to rush here, Lucy. What did you do? Marino has a way of acting as if everybody is guilty of something. I'm not sure why they're here, Lucy replies. I'm not sure of anything, except I got suspicious early this morning that something was up. Based on? Marino asks. Someone was on the property. Who? I never saw whoever it was. There was nobody on the cameras, but motion sensors went off. Maybe a small animal. I start walking again, very slowly. No, nothing was there, and yet something was. Plus, someone's in my computer. That's been going on for about a week. Well, I shouldn't say someone. I think we can figure out who it is. Let me guess. Considering who stopped by for an unexpected visit. Marino doesn't disguise how much he hates the FBI. Programs opening and closing on their own, and taking too long to load, she says. The cursor moving when I'm not touching it. Plus my computer was running slow, and the other day it crashed. No big deal. Everything is backed up. Everything vital is encrypted. It must be them. They're not particularly subtle. Anything leaked or corrupted? I ask. Anything at all? There doesn't appear to be. An unauthorized user account was created by someone pretty savvy, but no genius. And I'm on top of all that, monitoring unusual logins, all emails sent, trying to figure out what the hacker or hackers want. It's not a sophisticated attack, or we wouldn't know about it until it's too late. But it's the FBI for sure? Marino asks. I mean, it would make sense, since here they just showed up with a warrant. I can't say with certainty who's rooting me, but it's probably them, or related to them. The FBI often uses outside servers when they're investigating cybercrime, and alleged cybercrime is their excuse for snooping. You know, for example, if they have reason to suspect I'm laundering money or surfing kiddie porn sites, shit like that. So if it's them, they'll say they were investigating me for something totally trumped up, just so they can spy. What about my office? I ask about the most problematic scenario. Is it safe? Is there any chance our computers have been breached? Lucy is the systems manager and IT administrator for the CFC computer network. She does all the programming. She forensically examines all electronic and data storage devices turned in as evidence. While she may be the firewall that surrounds the most sensitive information associated with any death, she's also the biggest vulnerability. Should the wrong person get past her, it would be catastrophic. Cases could be compromised before they ever reach court. Charges could be dropped, verdicts could be overturned. Thousands of murderers, rapists, drug dealers, and thieves could be released from prison in Massachusetts and elsewhere. Why all of a sudden? I ask her. Why the interest right now, assuming it's the FBI? It started when I got back from Bermuda, she says. What the fuck did you do? Marino demands with his usual tact. Nothing, she says. But they're determined to fabricate a case that sticks. What case? Something, she says. Anything. I wouldn't be surprised if they've already convened a grand jury. In fact, you can count on it. In fact, I'm convinced. The feds have the nasty little habit of raiding a place after they've already got a grand jury ready to indict you. They don't base a case on the evidence. They base the evidence on the case they're determined to make, even if it's wrong, even if it's a lie. Do you know how rare it is for a grand jury not to indict someone? Less than 1% of the time. They aim to please the prosecutor. They hear only one side of the story. Where can we talk? I don't want to continue this conversation in her driveway. They can't hear us. I just knocked out the audio for that lamp and that one and the next one. She points at copper lampposts. But let's go someplace we don't have to worry about. My own personal Bermuda Triangle. They're watching, and all of a sudden we vanish from their radar. The agents searching her house are monitoring us on her security cameras, and I feel a rush of frustration. Lucy's battle with the feds is as old as wars in the Middle East. It's a power struggle, a clash that's gone on so long, I'm not sure anyone remembers exactly what started it. She was probably one of the most brilliant agents the Bureau ever hired, and when they eventually ran her off, that should have been the end of it. But it wasn't. It never will be. "Follow me," she says. Chapter 12. We trudge through bright green grass, spattered with poppies as red as blood and brazen with gold sunflowers, white daisies, orange butterfly weed, and purple aster. It's as if I'm wading through a Monet painting. And beyond a shady, fragrant stand of spruces, we emerge into a low-lying area I've never seen before. It looks like a place of meditation, or an outdoor church with stone slab benches and sculpted rock outcrops evocative of a pond filled by running water formed of river stones. I can't see the house or the driveway from here. Nothing but rolling grass and flowers and trees and the constant whomping of the helicopter. Lucy takes a seat on a boulder, while I choose a stone bench in dapples of light shining through dogwoods. Hard, unyielding surfaces aren't my first choice these days, and I sit down very carefully, doing what I can to diminish my discomfort. "Has this always been here?" I ask, and the light moves on my face as branches move in the wind, because I've never seen it. "It's recent," Lucy says, and I don't ask how recent. Since mid-June, I suspect. Since I almost died. I look around and don't see any sign of cameras, and guarding her rock garden is another sculpted dragon, this one small and comical, lounging on a huge chunk of rose quartz. Its red garnet eyes stare right at me as Marino tries the bench across from mine, shifting his position several times. "Shit," he says. "What are we, cave people? How about wooden benches or chairs with cushions? Ever thought of that?" He's dripping sweat in the heat and humidity, and he flaps irritably at bugs and checks his socks for ticks. "Jesus, did you forget to spray out here?" His dark glasses turn on Lucy. "There's damn mosquitoes everywhere." I use a garlic spray. Pet and people safe. Mosquitoes hate it.
"Really?
These must be friggin' Italian mosquitoes, because they love it." He slaps at something. "Steroids, cholesterol, large people who give off more carbon dioxide than the rest of us," Lucy says to him. "Plus you sweat a lot. Hanging garlic around your neck probably wouldn't help." "What does the FBI want?" I look up at the helicopter, hovering at no more than 1,000 feet. "What exactly? We need to figure this out while we have a few minutes to talk privately." "Their first stop was my gun vault," she replies. "So far, they've packed all of my rifles and shotguns." Carrie is suddenly in my mind again. I see her inside the dorm room, the MP5K strapped around her neck. I ask Lucy, "Do they seem interested in any gun in particular?"
"No."
"They must be looking for something in particular."
"Everything I have is legal and has nothing to do with the Copperhead shootings," Lucy says, "which they damn well know were committed with the precision-guided firearm recovered from Bob Rosado's yacht. They confirmed it's the weapon 2 months ago, so why are they still looking?" "If they're looking for anyone, it should be his rotten little shit of a son, Troy. He's at large. Carrie's at large. He's probably the latest Clyde to her Bonnie. And where's the FBI? Here on my property. This is harassment. It's about something else."
"I've got a couple shotguns you can borrow," Marino offers.
and the thumping 450 Bushmaster. That's all right. I've got more than they're bargaining for, she says. They have no idea what they're missing, what they're walking right past. Please don't poke a stick at them, I warn her. Don't give them cause to hurt you. Hurt? I think hurt is the point, and it's already started. Her bright green eyes look at me. They want me hurt. They intend to leave me unprotected so I can't take care of my family, my home. They're hoping all of us will end up defeated, annihilated, at each other's throats. Better yet, dead. They want all of us murdered. You need something. All you gotta do is ask, Marino says. With the likes of Carrie on the loose, you should have more firepower than just your handguns. They'll take those next, if they haven't already, she replies. And it really is outrageous that they listed handguns on the warrant. Plus, they're bagging up all of my kitchen cutlery. The Shun Fuji Santoku knives you gave to us, she says to me, adding yet another outrage. As far as we know, Carrie Grethen's recent deadly rampage includes a stabbing with a tactical knife. There's no evidence, not even a hint, that Lucy had anything to do with it, and her guns and the cutlery are completely inconsistent with the characteristics of the murder weapons. To clean out her gun vault, her kitchen is absurd. For an instant, Carrie's recent victims parade through my mind, seemingly random people, until I realized each of them had a connection to me, even if remotely. They never knew what hit them, except for Rand Bloom, the sleazy insurance investigator she stabbed and left on the bottom of a swimming pool. He would have had a moment, if not several, of terror, panic, and pain. But Julie Eastman, Jack Siegel, Jamal Nari, and Congressman Rosado didn't suffer. They were going about their business one second, and then nothingness, annihilation. And I envisioned the Carrie I saw on video touching the back of her neck between the first and second cervical vertebrae. Even then, she knew about the sweet spot for a hangman's fracture, and that such a catastrophic injury literally causes instant death. She's back. She's alive and more dangerous than she ever was, and even as I'm thinking this, I'm washed over by doubt. What if all of us are being tricked? I can't prove I've seen or heard from Carrie Grethen since the 1990s. She's left no real evidence that connects her with the crime spree that began late last year. What if it's not her who sent the video to me from Lucy's phone? I look at my niece. From the beginning, I say to her. What happened? Lucy sits on her big rock and explains that this morning at exactly 9:05, her house phone rang. The number is unlisted and unpublished, but that wouldn't stop the FBI from getting it, and it doesn't stop her from foiling their efforts and then some. She has communication technology that can easily outsmart anyone attempting to catch her by surprise, and in a matter of seconds, she knew the identity of the caller was Special Agent Aaron Loria, a recent transfer to the FBI's Boston division. 38 years old, born in Nashville, Tennessee, black hair, brown eyes, 5'10", 139 pounds. And as I hear Lucy say this, I don't show my shock. I don't let on that I know who Aaron Loria is. I don't react as Lucy goes on to explain that when Aaron was in range of the security cameras, facial recognition software verified that she is indeed Aaron Loria, a former beauty queen, a graduate of Duke University and its law school before she signed on with the Bureau in 1997. She was a street agent for a while, married to a hostage negotiator who left the Bureau and joined a law firm. They lived in Northern Virginia, had no kids, divorced in 2010, and soon after she married a federal judge 21 years her senior. Which one? Marino asks. Zeb Chase, Lucy says. No way! Judge No-Dos? He's called that for the opposite reason people might expect. And I remember his small predatory eyes beneath heavy lids as he slumped on the bench, his chin almost on his chest, like a black-robed vulture waiting for something to die. It was easy to misconstrue his posture as relaxed or half asleep, when in fact he couldn't have been more alert or aggressive, waiting for attorneys, for expert witnesses to make a miscalculated move. Then he would dive bomb, snatching them up to swallow alive. In my earliest years in Virginia, when he was still a U.S. attorney, we worked many cases together. Even though my findings usually supported the prosecution, Zeb Chase and I often clashed. I seemed to annoy him, and he got only more hostile once he was on the bench. To this day, I have no idea why, and I distantly recall that he might just hold the record for the judge who most frequently threatened to hold me in contempt. Now he's married to Erin Loria, who has her own history with Lucy, and therefore de facto has one with me. My internal weather vane moves. It points. I can't tell it what. Maybe I don't want to know. So Special Agent Loria moved to Boston, and her husband, the judge, is still in Virginia, Marino assumes. It's not like he can pick up and come after her, Lucy replies, and she's right. Judge Chase's duty station would be the Eastern District of Virginia, where he will hold his seat until he resigns, dies, or is removed from office. He can't pick up and relocate to Massachusetts, even though his wife did. At least I can be grateful for that. Are you certain of the year Erin Loria started with the FBI? I ask Lucy. 1997. As in the year you were there. Not the only year I was there, she says, as I think about Erin Loria being married to a federal official who was appointed by the White House. That's not good. It's not good at all. She'll claim that he has no more influence in her cases than Benton has in mine. She'll swear his honor has no professional involvement with her, that both of them stay completely within the legal boundaries and guidelines. Of course it isn't true. It never is. I realize you were at Quantico before and after 1997. I'm commenting to Lucy as my thoughts continue to slam into each other like billiard balls. That once you got started with the FBI, you never really left. Until they ran me out of Dodge, she says, as if it's nothing that for all practical intents and purposes, she was fired. Even before I was an agent, I was there summers, holidays, most weekends, every spare minute I had. You probably remember. I'd start arranging my classes so I could leave Charlottesville early Thursday morning and not come back until late Sunday. I was at Quantico more than I was in college. Jesus, Marino mutters. Erin Loria was there when you were, and it's not exactly a big place. That's right, Lucy says. Another blast from the past, just like Carrie. What did you step in during that informative time of your life, huh? Some superglue-like dog shit that you can't clean off? He means formative, but Lucy and I ignore it. We don't crack a smile. Not now, as we perch on our hard, unforgiving seats in Lucy's place of meditation, her church, her Stonehenge. You step in some special brand of it, he's saying, and you not only still have it on your damn shoes, but you're tracking it everywhere for the rest of us to step in. Which session? I can't believe this is happening. We overlapped, she says. Erin was at Quantico while I was an intern at ERF, while Carrie was there, yes, that's true. And they were familiar with each other. How familiar? I ask it blandly. Familiar enough. Lucy doesn't flinch. They got pretty friendly. Jesus Christ. Marino reaches around to his back and scratches another itch, real or perceived. It's hard to imagine that's a coincidence in light of everything else. Whatever you sprayed out here doesn't work, just so you know. I've got bites, big ones. You can see them from friggin' outer space. Erin and I were on the same floor in Washington dorm, but I don't remember her very well, except she was dismissive of me. Lucy is talking as Marino continues to claw and swat and bitch. I didn't know her firsthand. I didn't make friends with any of the new agents in training, not in that session, only in my own, which wasn't until 2 years later. Mostly, I recall that she was Miss Tennessee. It's as far as she got in her beauty queen career. Totally bombed the talent portion of the Miss America pageant, then went to law school, then applied to the FBI Academy. Great for undercover when you look like a Barbie doll, I guess. Well, hey, it gets you married to a judge, I guess. It gets you invitations to White House Christmas parties. You were at Quantico at the same time, meaning Erin would be familiar with your background beyond what would be in your personnel file. I allude to the specter of Carrie. Lucy doesn't say a word. Carrie Grethen. I'm out with it. Erin would know about her for a number of reasons. Erin would know exactly who and what Carrie is. Now she would, Lucy says, that's for sure. But in 1997, no one had any idea what they were dealing with. Including me. As far as we know, Carrie hadn't committed murder back then. She wasn't a 10 most wanted criminal. She wasn't locked up in a forensic psychiatric facility for the criminally insane and hadn't escaped from it yet. And she hadn't allegedly been killed in a helicopter crash off the coast of North Carolina. Certainly, when she worked at the ERF, she wasn't a known felon or presumed dead, and she and Erin Loria might have been allies. They might have been friends. They might have had an affair and still be in communication, and what a bizarre notion that is to contemplate. One of the most dangerous fugitives on the planet might be on amicable terms with an FBI agent married to a federal judge who was appointed by the President of the United States. My mind speeds through possible connections, adding 2 plus 2 and maybe getting 4, maybe getting 5, or some other wrong answer. Or maybe there's no answer, period. But it bothers me considerably that even as Erin Loria was making her way to Lucy's property barely 2 hours ago, I was sent a text message that included a link to a covert video recording Carrie made in Lucy's dorm room while the former Miss Tennessee turned FBI agent was living right down the hall. Worse, Carrie and Lucy argued about her in the recording. "Hold up a second," Marino says to Lucy. "Before we drink the Kool-Aid and start imagining all sorts of crazy crap, let's go back to when your house phone rang. Your software collected data on who it was. You discovered Special Agent Loria was leading the charge, and then what?" Literally, blow by blow. "I knew she was in a vehicle moving 14 miles per hour along the same road you were just on." Lucy pulls up her legs, planting her feet on the boulder, wrapping her arms around her bent knees. None of us can get comfortable in her outdoor church. Except the sun feels good, even if the humidity is oppressive, and the stirring air is sluggish but pleasant when it touches my damp skin. It's the kind of hot, heavy weather that promises a violent storm, and one is predicted for this afternoon. I look up at thick, dark clouds advancing from the south, and I fix on the helicopter loudly hovering near the water, hanging in the air like a huge black orca float in a Macy's parade. "I knew when she placed the call, she was about 50 yards from my gate," Lucy describes. "And when I asked her what I could help her with, she informed me the FBI had a warrant to search my house and any outbuildings associated with it. She ordered me to open the gate and leave it open. And within minutes, 5 bureau cars, including a canine, were in front of the house." "What time did you notice the helicopter?" I continued to watch it hover, rock solid, now over dense woods to the left of Lucy's house, which we can't see from where we're sitting. About the same time you rolled up. Let me get this straight. Marino frowns. For some reason, an FBI chopper just happened to be in Cambridge where we were working a case, and next, it just happened to follow us here? Okay, now I'm getting really hinky, you know? One of those really bad feelings that makes my hair stand up. You don't have any hair, Lucy says. What bullshit are they pulling? Marino glares up at the sky as if the FBI is God. Well, they sure as hell aren't going to tell me, she says. I don't know where they've been flying or for what reason, and there hasn't been time for me to check. After their cars showed up, I no longer had privacy. It wasn't a smart idea for me to check with ATC or tune into their freak to hear who was buzzing around and maybe why. Plus, I had a lot of other things to attend to. The canine in particular is upsetting. Intentionally. What I call being a real asshole. Who? Erin, I can only conclude. If she's gathered any information about me, she realizes that I have an English bulldog named Jet Ranger, who's so old he can hardly walk or see, and to have a Belgian Malinois searching the house would scare the hell out of him. Not to mention scaring Desi. Not to mention hassling Janet to the point she was about to deck someone. This is personal. Her green eyes are intense. She holds my stare. I wouldn't be so quick to assume that. I'm cautious about what I say. I wouldn't take any of this personally, I advise my niece, even as I wonder about her. All of us need to be coldly objective and think clearly right now. It feels like someone is settling a score. I admit, I'm wondering the same thing, Marino says. This is planned. Lucy seems convinced. It's been planned for a while. What score and who? I inquire. Not Carrie. Not Carrie my ass, Marino snarls. I'll just come right out and say it. I keep going, but I'm careful. Carrie isn't giving orders to the FBI, even if she might have known Erin Loria while all of you were at Quantico together. The two of them weren't exactly strangers. Lucy stretches out her long, lean legs, starts doing lifts for her abs, her eyes fixed on her blaze orange running shoes moving up and down. Not hardly, she adds. Aw, hell. Don't tell me they were sleeping with each other, too. Marino shifts his position on the hard bench, massaging the small of his back. Does the judge know? I don't know how much sleeping went on, Lucy says, as if it no longer bothers her, and I don't believe that. Well, one thing we know about Carrie is she's an equal opportunity employer, Marino says. Age, race, gender, nothing holds her back. This story's only getting worse. I remember walking into the cafeteria one time and noticing them eating at the same table, Lucy says to me and not him. Now and then I saw them talking in the gym. And there was the rainy morning when Carrie ran the yellow brick road and slipped when she was scaling down a rock face. She got a really bad rope burn and told me one of the new agents helped her, cleaned up the wound and dressed it. It was Erin Loria. I do remember that. And suspecting the reason Erin might have helped her wasn't because they happened to be in the same place at the same time. They weren't just bumping into each other. They were running the obstacle course together. But beyond that, Lucy shrugs, lifting her face to the sun, shutting her eyes. Carrie was a lot more outgoing than I was, if you know what I mean. You ever hear her talk about Erin? Specifically discuss her? Marino asks. Not really. But Carrie's a master manipulator. She's a politician. She's a lot better with people than I'll ever be, and can get almost anyone to cross the line with her. Exactly. And we don't know who she might be in communication with, Marino retorts, and we don't know who the FBI might be talking to. Bottom feeders will get information any way and from any source they can. They make deals with the devil all the time.
I agree, Lucy says. She's fed them something, even if it's indirectly.
Chapter 13. As she talks, she triggers more images from the video she doesn't know about. Or I assume she doesn't know about it. And then I entertain another unsavory possibility. If Carrie is in fact the person who texted the video link to me, then she might also be sending things like that to the FBI. She might have sent the same recording to Aaron Loria, and I don't want to think about what the feds could do with it. How embarrassing for Lucy. How dangerous. And then I think of the illegal machine gun again. It might be why they're here right now. Only thing about Carrie feeding the FBI information or having anything to do with anything, Marino adds. I doubt they believe she exists. Seriously. They genuinely might believe she's dead, just like we did until 2 months ago. Forget the judge. Forget your Quantico past. Forget everything, except that there's no proof Carrie's alive. Doesn't matter our opinion. Our opinion? I look at him. Is it merely an opinion that she shot me with a spear gun and it's a miracle I didn't hemorrhage to death or drown? That's her favorite thing, making you think she doesn't exist, Lucy says with her eyes shut, her face peaceful in the bright light. She's calm, but beneath it all, she can't be. I don't know of anyone more private than my niece. The idea of agents going through every inch of her personal life is unimaginable. It occurs to me that I might be next, and I wonder what Benton would do if a squadron of his colleagues showed up at our picture-perfect antique Cambridge home. Let's stick with what's under our nose. Marino gives up on his slab bench, standing and stretching. What are they saying you did, Lucy? You know the feds. She shrugs from her perch on a rock. They don't say what they think you're guilty of, and they don't ask. They throw things up against the wall until they find something that sticks. Like maybe you don't remember a detail exactly right. Maybe you say you went to the store on Saturday, and it was really Sunday, so now they get you for a false statement, a felony. I don't suppose you've called Jill Donahue. I'm sure I know the answer. She's one of the most highly regarded criminal defense attorneys in the United States, and a brilliant dirty fighter. That's exactly what we need right now. It doesn't mean I like her. I haven't contacted her or anyone. Lucy confirms what I suspect. Why not? I ask. She should have been your first call. Come on, Lucy, you know better than that, Marino says. You can't be dealing with them and not have a lawyer. What's wrong with you? I used to be them. I know how to think like them, she says. I wanted to cooperate with them long enough to gather intelligence on what exactly it is they're so hot and bothered about. Or what they're pretending they're so hot and bothered about. And? I ask. She shrugs again. I can't tell if she doesn't have an answer or refuses to say. I'm gonna wander up to the house to see what the hell they're doing, Marino decides. Don't worry, I won't go inside, but I'll make sure they see me. Fuck 'em. Janet, Desi, and Jet Ranger are in the boathouse, Lucy says to him. Maybe you can check on them. Make sure they stay there. They need to stay in the boathouse. And remember, Jet Ranger can't swim. Do not let him near the edge of the dock, she adds emphatically. Not anywhere near it. They aren't to let him out of their sight, she says. And it's then I see it. An involuntary muscle reaction to an intensely unpleasant thought. And tell them I'll be right there, Lucy says. And I detect her murderous anger. Just as quickly, it's hidden under her many layers, down deep in a space that's not reachable. Like a diver breaking the surface and then dropping down and gone. Nothing there but the rocking sea and the light caught by the water and the flatness of an empty horizon. I don't remember. I just know it happened. It's what I imagine it must be like to be born, to be warm and submerged, then suddenly, violently forced through the birth canal and shocked and manhandled into breathing, into living this life. I have no memory of Benton helping me to the surface. I can't recall reaching the stern of the boat or how I got up on it. I couldn't have climbed the ladder. My first real memory is someone holding a mask over my face, giving me oxygen, and how dry my mouth was. It felt as if my right thigh was in a vise that was clamped so tight it was crushing my femur. It was the worst pain I've ever experienced. At least that's my impression of it now. The black carbon fiber spear had entered through the quadriceps, perforating the vastus medialis and in the process grazing the bone before protruding from the other side of my leg. When I saw it, I didn't understand. For a bizarre instant, I thought I'd been involved in a construction accident and my thigh was impaled by rebar. Then I didn't believe what I was seeing was reality until I touched the tip of the spear, and pain reverberated along the shaft. I saw blood on my hands and smears of blood on the fiberglass flooring of the boat. I kept feeling for my inner thigh, making sure the spear was nowhere near my femoral artery. Dear God, please don't let me bleed to death. You're going to bleed to death. No, if you were going to, you already would have. I remember what was going through my mind. The thoughts were splinters piercing my awareness, disconnected bits and pieces, and then blackness, and then I would drift back. I'd have a vague awareness of lying on the floor of the boat. I remember blood and a lot of towels, and Benton leaning close to me. Benton, Benton, where am I? What's happened? He gently kept my legs still, and as he made me breathe, he talked to me. He explained everything. He says he did, but I can't replay it. Not a word of it now. It's all so hazy. It's so strangely out of reach. Does Desi have any idea what's going on? I ask Lucy, focusing on her, realizing she's not sitting anymore. Are you okay? She stands over me. Where were you just then? I don't tell her that when I go there, wherever there is, it's like disjointed fragments of a dreadful illusion. It constantly enters my mind that I died and came back, and I won't share such thoughts. I won't mention the intrusions, the sensations and images that suddenly seize me when I least expect it. The cues are imperceptible. The spitting of a cigarette lighter, of a hose spraying, a movement in the corner of my eye. Then out of nowhere, suddenly, violently, like a seizure, the tugging, the screaming pain reverberates inside my brain. It was as if my leg was in the jaws of a shark, yanking, swimming away with me. I accepted my fate. I was about to drown. Then everything went empty and dark like a power outage. And suddenly, crazily, I hear it again. The C-sharp chord of an electric guitar. My eyes land on my phone, absently gripped in one hand, at the message at the top of the display. Lucy, ice message. I enter my password and go to my messages, and this one is just like the other, a link and nothing more. But it can't be from Lucy. How can it be? There's no way. She's standing not even 6 feet from me. She recognizes the alert tone that she knows so well and meets my eyes. Next, she looks at her own phone, then at me. I didn't just text you, she says. I know. Better put, I didn't see you do it. You didn't see me? I just heard the alert tone for my ice line, my second line on this phone. She holds it up and looks baffled and wary. And I didn't send you anything. Yes, I'm aware I didn't see you touch your phone. Why are you talking like this? I'm just commenting on what I did and didn't see, I reply. Have you assigned that tone to anyone else? You customized my ringtones, created this one for me because it's unique, Lucy. No other caller in my contacts list has... Okay, she interrupts impatiently. What number is showing up? There isn't one. It just says Lucy Ice, which is how I have the number labeled in my contacts list. And if I go to contacts now and look, there. I hold up my phone, but don't let her get close. It looks exactly as it always has. Lucy Ice. I recite the phone number. And that's yours. I look her in the eye. Is it possible someone's hijacked it? Specifically, is it possible someone has found a way to hijack your in-case-of-emergency line so it appears you're calling or texting urgently when in fact you're not? A great way to get your attention. To make you stop everything you're doing, just like you are right now. A great way to manipulate you to respond as directed at a precise time for a certain reason. Lucy looks around as if someone might be watching, then walks over and holds out her hand. Let me see. I'm not about to give her my phone, and I step back from her. I need to take a look. She continues to hold out her hand for my phone. I promise whatever you just got isn't from me. Let me see what it is. I'm not going to do that. Why not? Legally, I can't. Legally, I won't be that reckless. I don't know for a fact who's doing this, Lucy. Doing what? Sending me things as if they're from you. And you worry it might really be me doing it? She looks hurt, then stung. I don't know for a fact who it is, I repeat. What do you mean by legally? She begins to react angrily, and so do I. You're just like them. You think I did something. The FBI's all over my property, so that makes me guilty of something? We're not discussing this. You didn't overhear anything, not even a ringtone, dammit, and you need to step back. I'm dismayed by the tone in my voice, and Lucy is about to lose her temper. I can't help if you withhold things from me, Aunt Kay. You can help by answering my very simple question, Lucy. Could someone be spoofing your number? Could someone have hijacked it? You know better than anyone that I don't give out my phone numbers. Her arms are defiantly crossed. I almost never call anybody from my emergency line anyway. And nobody has that number except you. And Benton, Marino, and Janet, of course. Well, it seems somebody has it. I'm wondering how that could happen. Especially to you. I don't know how. I don't know enough yet. I almost never hear you say you don't know. I carefully, painfully get up from my stone slab. I need a few minutes of privacy, please. I dig into a pocket for my wireless earpiece. I put it on as I click on the link, and immediately text rolls by, blood red like before. Depraved Heart, Video 2, by Carrie Grethen, July 11, 1997. I feel the stone dragon watching from his rose quartz perch. His glinting red garnet eyes seem to follow me as I move as far from Lucy as I can. Carrie's face looms large and porpoise-like as she peers into a micro-camera disguised as a battery-operated beige plastic pencil sharpener shaped like a brick. She picks it up and films herself from different angles, then directs the tiny lens inside the dark pink cavern of her mouth. She wags her tongue, and it moves hugely, fatly in different tempos like an obscene metronome. Slowly up and down, side to side very fast. She rapidly touches her pink lips together, and they make musical popping sounds. Then she holds up the pencil sharpener like the skull in Hamlet and talks directly to it. To be or not to be God? That is the question. Whether 'tis nobler to suffer the abstinence of putting off pleasure, or should I give in to instant gratification? The answer is no. I must not give in. I must be patient as required, no matter how difficult or demanding. God plans events millions of years in advance, and so can I, Chief, she says, and I hear it again, a sentence that has been edited. Who is she talking to when she says Chief? Howdy. Welcome back. Carrie walks over to the computer on the desk, sets down the pencil sharpener, pulls out the chair, and sits. Reaching for the mouse, she clicks it on, and a paused image of Lucy and me fills the screen. In it, I'm gesturing mid-sentence while Lucy sits on top of a wooden picnic table, listening, smiling. I recognize the pearl gray silk suit I had on, long since given away. Carrie must have had a zoom lens. She must have been out of sight, and I instantly recognize the perspective, the weather, the foliage. The ERF's parking lot, hot and sunny, late in the day. The canopies of the hardwood trees are densely green and mature. There is no sign of the leaves turning, not the slightest hint of red or gold. It's summertime, July or August. It could be the second half of June, but not the first half. No earlier than mid to late June. Carrie might have been inside a car, filming Lucy and me at the picnic tables in the wooded area flanking the employee parking lot. And I see it, feel it, smell it as if I'm there. I have on the elegant silk suit that Benton gave me for my birthday, June 12th, almost exactly 1 month before Marino's. In 1995, I'm pretty sure, and I know for a fact I wore the suit only once to court because it wrinkled terribly. By the time I was called to the stand, the skirt looked like it'd been balled up in a drawer before I put it on. The wrinkles radiating from under the arms of the jacket are huge crow's feet. I see the suit clearly. I remember making a joke about it to Lucy. It was a Northern Virginia case, not far from Quantico, and I stopped by after court and had lunch with her in the picnic area. Not in 1997. Definitely not. She was just starting her internship, and I was laughing about my suit. I said it showed sweat stains, too, and that Benton was a typical man who didn't think of things like that. He may be sensitive and hyperintuitive and have exquisite taste, but he shouldn't be picking out clothes for me. I don't work for the Bureau, I remember saying to Lucy, or words to that effect. I don't dress for meetings in war rooms. I dress for a landfill. Wash and wear, that's me. As early as 1995, and already Carrie was spying. She may have been covertly recording Lucy, and even me, soon after she met us, and I look at my phone display and watch Carrie get up from the desk 2 years later, in July 1997. I watch her walk across the dorm room. Pay attention. Don't let your memories distract you from her manipulations. Are you having a nice trip down memory lane, Chief? Because I have a feeling you're having a nice, long, leisurely stroll, remembering all sorts of things you've not thought about in the longest time. Carrie finds another camera, talks directly into it. I wish I knew what stardate you're in at this very moment. I'm here inside Lucy's cramped, unimaginative boudoir in this land of walking dicks who wear guns and flash their badges. Carrie is barefoot and in the same white running clothes, and the light seeping around the outer edges of the slatted blinds isn't as intense as earlier. It's later in the day. Lucy just stepped out for a few minutes to be domestic. Surprised? I imagine you are scratching your head, and I wonder. Okay, tell me the truth. Carrie leans toward the camera conspiratorially. Does she help out around her Auntie Kay's house? Does she do dishes, or clean toilets, or take out the trash, or even offer? If not, you should work with her on that particular aspect of her considerable immaturity and spoiledness. Because I have no problem getting her to be responsible. I simply tell her, Lucy, do this or do that, and snap to it. Carrie laughs as she snaps her fingers. Right now, she's taking care of our dirty laundry. So while we have a second alone, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what to expect. By the time you see this, months and years will have passed. I don't know how many. It could be 5. It could be 30. They will pass in the twinkling of an eye, and the older we get, the faster time will speed on, carrying us closer to dilapidation and physical non-existence. Already, the days seem to go more quickly for me than they do for Lucy, and your days must go much faster than either of ours because the brain's biological clock, the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the hypothalamus, she taps her forehead, ages just like the rest of us. What changes isn't time, but our perception of it, as the instruments inside our biological vessel are subject to stress, fatigue, and wear and tear. They become less accurate, like a precessing directional gyro or a wet compass out of calibration, and what you perceive isn't accurate anymore. Already your memory bumps should be moving you back in time like an assembly line. Already the past is being reconstructed and restored rapidly and miraculously as you relive what you see, and what a wonderful ride that will be. Consider it my gift to you. A bit of immortality, a spritz from the fountain of youth. But as I continue to emphasize by way of an apology, I can't say when. At this juncture in time and space, I honestly can't predict when I will decide the history of the world is perfectly poised and suited for you to be properly and at long last enlightened about the meaning of your life and death, and the beginnings and ends of all the people on earth who matter to you, including me. Yes, me. We've never had an opportunity to be friends. We've never had a substantive conversation. Not even a cordial one. And that's shocking when one considers what you could learn from me. Let me fill you in on a few facts about Carrie Grethen. Another hidden camera picks her up as she walks across the room to an army green canvas backpack on the floor. She crouches and digs inside it. She finds a manila envelope that isn't sealed and slides out folded sheets of paper. More pages of a script. Did you know I'm a writer, a raconteur, an artiste? That I'm a devotee of Hemingway, Dostoevsky, Salinger, Kerouac, Capote? Of course not. You wouldn't want to humanize me. You wouldn't want to assign anything positive or noteworthy, no pun intended, such as an appreciation for poetry and prose. Or that I have a very wicked sense of humor. I offer a brief character sketch that will give you a few clues, and you go right ahead and share them with whoever you like. Put them in one of your boring technical books. Now there's an idea. Please excuse that I prefer the third person when I talk about myself. I don't talk about me. I talk about her. Are you ready? Are you sure? Chapter 14. Once upon a time, there was an alchemist who prepared her own special protective potions that kept her forever young. Carrie holds up the bottle of lotion as she reads from her script. With her very fair skin, she touches her pale cheek, and very fair hair, she touches her platinum hair. She blended like a moth inside the bland, off-white FBI dorm room, as if natural selection was the explanation for what she'd become. But it wasn't. Something else had leached the color out of her soul, mutating it and creating paranormal cravings and behaviors that made her seek out lightlessness and gloom. As a young child, Carrie knew she wasn't good. When people at church talked about good stewards, good Samaritans, good believers, pure of heart, she knew she wasn't one of them. From the earliest age, she knew she wasn't like anyone at school or inside her own home. She wasn't like anyone at all. And while this was confusing, it also pleased her greatly that she had been unusually blessed. Such a rare gift, not to mind extreme temperatures, to scarcely feel heat or cold, and to see in the dark like a cat. What a treat to leave her body during sleep and travel to distant lands and into the past, to speak languages she'd never learned and remember places she'd never been. Carrie's IQ was too high to measure. But to whom much is given, much also can be taken. And one day her mother uttered the terrible words that no child should ever hear. Little Carrie's destiny was to die young. She was so special that Jesus couldn't bear to be without her long and would take her back to heaven early. "Think of it as a holy layaway plan," Carrie's mother explained. "Jesus was shopping, and as he browsed through all the millions of new babies about to be born, he picked you out and set you aside. Very soon he'll return to pick you up and take you home with him forever." "Then he has to get the money to pay for me?" Carrie inquired. "Jesus doesn't need money. Jesus can do whatever he wants. He's perfect and all-powerful." "Then why didn't he just pay for me when he found me and take me home with him?" "It's not for us to question Jesus. But it sounds like he's poor and not very powerful after all, Mommy. It sounds like he couldn't afford me the same way you can't afford things you put on layaway." "You must never say anything disrespectful about our Lord and Savior."
"But I didn't, Mommy. You did. You said he can't afford me right now, or else I'd be gone from here and in heaven with him, and then I wouldn't be a burden for you anymore. You don't want me and wish I was dead."
Carrie's mother responded by washing her young daughter's mouth out with a bar of ivory soap, twisting it so hard that the bright white cake turned red from her bleeding gums. After that, her mother gave up on the layaway analogy, realizing it was close to what she meant, but not quite right. Instead, she took to reminding Carrie that she should live an exemplary, pure-hearted life, and to thank God for it while she could, because none of us knows how long we'll be here anyway. She explained that what she really meant when she brought up the metaphor of a layaway plan was that life on Earth is like being in the back room of a department store. Some of us will be in that back room a shorter time than others, depending on what we came equipped with before we were put in storage on this Earth waiting for Jesus. In other words, what her mother really was referring to when she used that corny layaway analogy was the family flaw, a potentially fatal one that Carrie had inherited. This wasn't made up. It was an unfortunate fact, and by Carrie's 14th year, she'd lost both her maternal grandmother and her mother to thromboembolus caused by the bone marrow abnormality, polycythemia vera. Carrie made a pact with God that she wouldn't suffer a similar fate, and like clockwork, every 2 months she underwent phlebotomy, removing as much as a pint of blood that she would retain for her own personal use. It wasn't the only interesting ritual that would follow her well into adulthood. Carrie walks around the dorm room, gesturing, looking into the camera. She's enjoying herself. She's loving this. Eventually, odd rumors about her would circulate at the FBI's engineering research facility, she continues, where it would have been a civil rights violation to question their most senior civilian computer savant About her health, about her personal beliefs and how they were manifested. It was nobody's business if she saved or drank her own blood, or was polysexual, or communed with the other world. Her appetites and fantasies were of no concern as long as she kept them to herself. How long she lived wasn't relevant either. Only that she finished the important job the federal government had recruited her to do. A technical feat that didn't call for an FBI special agent, and Carrie wasn't one. Professionally, she was classified as a non-law enforcement, non-military independent contractor with special security clearances. Personally, she was considered a nerd, a weirdo, a nobody who was called derisive and crude nicknames behind her back. Her eyes are dark and cold as they bore into the camera. Sexist, vulgar names and snipes that the FBI didn't think Carrie overheard. But she did. And her upbringing had prepared her well for not reacting to taunts or retaliating or doing anything that gave the enemy any power. Punishment isn't punishment if you don't feel punished. If you don't experience the suffering that's intended. It's all about perception. It's all about the way you react to something, and that reaction is a real weapon. The weapon is what injures. And in your case, I'm banking on you being injured by your own self, by your own reactions, because you've yet to learn a lesson no one had to teach me. If you feel no pain and show no injury, then there was no weapon, only a weak attempt. Her mellow, pleasant voice, with its subtle Virginia lilt, suddenly stops and the frame goes black. It's the same as before. The link is disabled. Instantly, it's gone like the first one. Jill Donahue is unavailable, and I insist that her secretary interrupt her. I don't give orders unless I mean it, and right now I feel like an engine about to over-torque. I know I don't sound particularly nice, but I can't help it. I'm sorry, Dr. Scarpetta, but it's a deposition, the secretary tries to plead with me. They're supposed to break at noon. Noon won't work. I need her now, and I'm very sorry. I'm sure whatever she's doing is important, but it's not as important as this. Please get her for me, I reply. And I think about patience, about whether I'm a patient person, because I certainly don't sound like it. I don't for a very good reason, I decide. Not this morning. And Carrie knew what she was doing. She's giving me clues. And as much as I can't stand to think about how manipulated I feel, it would be reckless and foolish to wear blinders. She's made it clear that everything is about timing. Therefore, it stands to reason that the timing of the texts landing in my phone isn't random. I wonder if she's spying, even as I stand in Lucy's rock garden, the sun moving in and out of white clouds that are ruffled like a washboard underneath. The tops of them building vertically. The storm is coming. A whopper summer thunder cell, and I smell its ozone approach as I begin to wander well beyond Lucy's outdoor sanctuary. Thick green grass springy beneath my boots. I move into the partial shade of a dogwood tree, waiting for my pulse to slow down.